We're going to talk about modal quantum theory, which is not real quantum theory. It's fake quantum theory. It's a toy model. It's what you might call paraphysics, where we don't study physics as it actually is, but we try to think of physics as maybe it might have been. This work that I want to talk about is in collaboration with Mike Westmoreland at Denison University, who will be visiting starting next week. And so let me tell you what we're up to. So this is actual quantum theory. We're going to abbreviate actual quantum theory, AQT. Actual quantum theory is a theory that has a lot of mathematical structure. There are a lot of mathematical pieces that fit together and produce the quantum theory that we know and love. Here's a list of fairly simple axioms that are pretty good from Chris Fuchs, and there's actually lots of axioms on the list, and the axioms are about a pretty deep structure, a Hilbert space, and Hilbert spaces. They have vectors which we use to describe pure states and the basis states for measurements. They have operators, and we do all kinds of things with operators there. They describe mixed states. They describe observables. They describe time evolution of isolated systems and all sorts of things. In the theory, we wind up with probabilities. We calculate probabilities from squaring the magnitude of complex probability amplitudes. And that's the whole business of quantum theory, and it's very elaborate. Now, of course, if you're worried about what quantum theory means, or you want to see why quantum theory is so special, that it's so special that it's actually the way things really are, that one of the things you might do is you might ask, what if things were otherwise? What if we tinkered with some of the axioms of quantum theory? And this is a game with a distinguished pedigree. People are forever doing things like, well, what if quantum theory had a little bit of nonlinearity, or what if we had only real or quaternionic probability amplitudes, and so on. You can play those games. You can find out how the quantum theory that results would be a little bit different. So this is yet another round of that same game, but I think it has some interesting features. So let's go on. The thing we're going to leave out of quantum theory is probability. We're going to leave it out entirely. And instead of probability, we're going to make do with a much simpler and more primitive notion, the notion of possibility. Okay? So probability, in sort of a naive way of expressing it, you have a set of events, and there's a probability measure. And that probability measure, the probability of an event, is between 0 and 1. When you add them all up, you get 1. And events are more or less likely according to their probability measure. And likely is here to be an intuitive notion for you. And this is, in fact, what probability is the way we measure likelihood. And quantum mechanics, as we know, makes probabilistic predictions for experiments. And so this may seem like these are kind of essential, but we want to do without. What we're going to do is we're going to substitute that with merely the notion of possibility. So you have a set of events, but instead of having some kind of probability measure over that set of events, you simply have a subset, a non-empty subset, of the things which are possible. If it's in the subset, it's possible. If it's not in the subset, it's impossible. So the thing that you have to remember throughout the talk today is that we aren't going to smuggle in any additional notions of likelihood. We will distinguish between things that are possible and things that are impossible. And there are also some things that are necessary. That's if it's possible and it's the only thing that's possible. It's impossible that it's not true, then it's a necessary thing. But those are the only notions that we're going to have in our theory. And the temptation which you must guard against is to try to impose a probability measure on it. Because it's extremely difficult to do that in a consistent way, so we won't even try. Okay. Now, these concepts of possibility and necessity are actually concepts familiar from what's called modal logic, which is a branch of logic that deals with not simply statements, but also statements about the statements, like this thing is true, or maybe this thing is possibly true. But I say the connection is very weak because modal logicians think about things like, okay, if that's possibly true, is it necessary that it's possibly true? This is the kind of question that the modal logician considers. That's a serious question. That's Becker's axiom, one of the basic axioms of modal logic, is about that particular question. But we're not going to consider that at all. This is all the notion of possibility we need. Okay. So I guess I'll just go ahead and give you the axioms of modal quantum theory, and we'll sort of discuss them and see what they're like. These axioms are the results of a couple of false starts of trying to make a sensible theory like this, but let's take a look. Okay, modal quantum theory. All right. First thing you have in modal quantum theory is you have states. And the states are elements of a vector space, because we want to still have the principle of superposition. We want to still have the basic linear structure of quantum theory. But this vector space is over a field, and I'm not going to insist that field is the complex numbers. Indeed, in all the really interesting examples, that field is finite. It has only a finite number of elements. So the vector space, if it has finite dimension, may only have a finite number of vectors in it. It's all a very discrete theory. So the field might be finite, and because that's true, the vector space need have no norm. It need have no inner product. Nothing like a norm or an inner product is present in modal quantum theory. And the state of the system is a vector. Well, it can't be the zero vector. What could it be? Any non-zero vector, because there's no sense of normalization. Any non-zero vector is a potential state of our modal quantum system. All right, so now we have states. What about measurements? Well, a measurement corresponds to a basis for the vector space. Now, not an orthonormal basis, because we have no concept of ortho and we have no concept of normal, but some sort of basis, a vector space basis, and each basis element corresponds to one of the results of the measurement. And so here's how it works. You take your state, you expand it in terms of the basis. That's unique. You look at the coefficients, and if the coefficient is not equal to zero, that corresponding measurement result is possible. And if the coefficient is zero, it's impossible. And so that's the measurement theory we have. That's what we mean by a measurement. That's what we mean that's how we calculate whether something is possible or not. Yeah.
Going to tell us about that this is consistent. In other words, that you can't expand it in two different ways and get one thing being both possible and impossible. Thereby hangs an interesting tale. We will indeed talk about that, but I'm going to save that because that's an interesting story, and it leads us to go just a little deeper than these axioms.
In the absence of a measurement, we say that the system evolves in a linear way, there's some linear operator that takes the initial state to the final state. Notice that if that you might not be able to do this in any sort of continuous way because the space might be discrete. You might have to have discrete time to do this. And also, since you don't want any non-zero vector to evolve into a zero vector, the kernel of your transformation had better be the null space, and so it's got to be an invertible linear operator. That's the requirement. Not unitary. Unitary preserves inner products. We don't have inner products. Okay, so, all right. And finally, we're going to keep the usual quantum rule for composite systems. When we put two systems together, we simply take the tensor product of the state spaces for the two systems. So that's a quantum-like rule. So you can see there are affinities to the quantum theory that we know, and I'm hoping that my PSI students are registering all these affinities at this moment. But it's not quite the same. It lacks a lot of the machinery that we have in quantum theory.
Why is that as important as the others?
I mean, the invertibility comes not so much from time reversibility, but from the fact that we want to insist that no state is mapped to the zero vector. And that means that the kernel of the linear transformation right. has to be the zero space, and that implies invertibility even in this general context.
If it's finite dimensional, are you assuming that the vector space is finite dimensional?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with finite dimensional examples. So we can assume that. Yes.
What happens to the state after measurement? Does it just go to the A?
As in quantum theory, there's a very special kind of situation in which the so-called projection postulate holds. But real measurements, it doesn't necessarily hold. At a more advanced development that I'm going to talk about here, you can talk about what the measurement actually does to the state of the system. We won't need that for what we talk about today. But that actually opens up a really interesting set of questions that we can talk about later. Yes?
How do you distinguish between necessary and possible?
Well, if only one of these coefficients is non-zero, then that result is the only possible result. The only possible result is a necessary result. Right. Okay.
So let's try these out for a test drive. Let's take the simplest possible example. The simplest possible example would have the tiniest field we can think of, which is Z2. And the vector space has two dimensions. So that's what we might call a modal quantum bit, or a MoBit. I don't expect this to appear in the Scrabble dictionary very soon. So the simplest possible situation is our field is Z2, and that's actually a very nice domain for looking at really interesting, extremely simple examples. And the dimension is equal to 2. And by the way, since we have lots of choices of this, modal quantum theory is actually a family of theories, one for each choice of the field. And they're interestingly different. And we won't actually run into that today, but there are some distinctions you can make. Okay, so there are only 3 possible states of the MoBit. There's 0 and 1, 2 basis states we can call 0 and 1, and then there is the superposition of 0 and 1, which we call sigma for superposition. In fact, any two of these is a superposition of the third. Because, of course, if you add any vector to itself, you get 0. And you should remember Z2 is a situation where if you add 1 plus 1, you get 0. So because these things, the coefficients of the vectors, which sort of act like possibility amplitudes, if you will, because they can add together in this way, you find that we can have interference effects, but only destructive interference, the only kind of interference we have. Because if you add any two non-zero things together, you get 0 in this field. Okay, now there are 3 basis sets that are useful, which we can call X, Y, and Z, just because we have a fond memory of spin 1/2 systems or something. And the Z one is the 0, 1 basis, and then any two of these guys can serve as a basis. We can have the X basis or the Y basis, and we can expand any state in terms of them. Well, it's pretty trivial because there are only 3 states. It's either this one, or the superposition. It's either this one, or the superposition. Now we're going to answer Bill's question. So if you're given a state, let's say the superposition state sigma, and you measure in a basis that includes the state 0, is this outcome possible? And the answer to this question is, it depends. If your measurement is a measurement of the Z observable with this basis, then sigma is the sum of these two basis vectors. And since the coefficient of this guy, which is the 0, which is the vector 0, the vector named 0, not the 0 vector, the coefficient of this guy is non-zero, it's possible. That outcome is possible. But if you measure in basis Y, which also contains 0 as one of the basis elements, this state is actually one of the basis elements, the other one. And therefore, the coefficient of this basis element is zero. And therefore, this result is not possible. So it's not quite as simple as just being able to answer this question with in the absence of knowing what the whole basis is. Unless I know the whole basis, I won't be able to tell you whether this corresponds to a possible outcome or not. Okay, well, unless we think a little deeper. What you really need to think about is the dual space, the space of linear functions of linear, of course, in the finite field, the space of linear functions on the original space V. Now, it's a space of exactly the same dimension, exactly the same size. It has three elements, and if you have a basis for V, that always corresponds to a dual basis, a basis of linear functionals in V star. Now, I've written this guy in a way that's reminiscent of a bra. But this is something in a quite different space. There is no direct natural correspondence between vectors in here and vectors in there. That correspondence in Hilbert space depends on the existence of the inner product. If you don't have a metric around, you can't raise or lower indices. So, but it's true that this basis as a collection corresponds to a basis in the dual space. And how does that work? Well, this basis vector, this basis dual vector, acting on the state, is equal to the component of this vector with respect to this basis. Okay, so the basis functionals are just the ones that pick out the components. The functional that corresponds to the zero vector in those two bases before, those two functionals are not the same functional. Those two functionals are not the same functional. The correspondence between a basis vector and a basis functional depends on the entire basis. Okay, so what we're going to say is a measurement is associated with a basis for V star, in fact. Of course, this always corresponds to a basis for the original vector space. So there's a, this is not anything new. It's just a new way of saying what I had before. And each measurement result A is now represented in here by a dual vector, which we'll call the effect functional for that measurement result. It's a functional. And then the possibility rule is that this measurement is one of the possible results. This measurement result is one of the possible results if that functional acting on the state is non-zero. So if we think about the effect functionals as just living in the dual space, then the rule is very nice because this only depends on this effect functional, not which basis for V star it lives in. Yes?
I'm confused about what the difference is between the definition of the dual space and having an inner product.
Well, if we have an inner product, then
if you give me a vector in the space, I can tell you, without any further information, what vector in the dual space corresponds to it. But that depends on the choice of basis. My point is that if I have two different bases, let's go back to the previous. If I have two different bases, this basis and this basis, in one of them, this vector has a non-zero component of this basis vector, which means that the dual vector corresponding to this, I would write that in the new language as for the z basis acting on sigma is not equal to zero. But if I consider the x basis, then the functional that I will label zero, that is to say, this I really should label plus sub z, and this I really should label minus sub x. But anyway, the one that sort of corresponds to the zero vector, to the vector named zero in the basis, this acting on sigma is zero. So these are not the same. These are not the same. I cannot say once and for all which vector in the dual space corresponds to which vector in the original space.
A wide, right, I'm sorry.
Now I don't have an eraser. Oh, there's one. Thank you. Right. In Y, of course.
Okay. So, however, if we look in the dual space, there is an object. It lives in the dual space. It's called, and we're going to associate
that object with a measurement result here. And then, once I make that association, once I have the effect functional in hand, then I can tell whether that corresponding measurement result is possible or not without knowing what the other basis functionals are. Yeah?
There isn't this.
Oh, right. Okay, so it's a little bit tricky. But let me see if I can tell you. Essentially, in the
MoBit, you can identify basis functionals by which vectors they take to zero. Okay, which vectors they take to zero. Each of them will take two of the vectors to zero, or no, sorry, one vector to zero and two of them to one. There are three vectors in the vector space V, and each of the basis functionals will map one of them to zero and two of them to one. And so I can consider, I can enumerate my functionals by saying the one that takes the zero state to zero, the one that takes the one state to zero, and the one that takes the sigma state to zero. Okay? Now, if I were to look at the Z basis, if I have a vector, I want to write it as something times zero, these are modal states, plus something else times one. And if I want to pick this out, I need to find the basis vector, find the basis functional that will give me one when I apply this, but zero when I apply that. So the one that I would have called the zero functional is really the thing that maps one to zero, the annihilator of one. And similarly, one is the annihilator of zero. However, that's for Z. However, for Y, for the Y vector space, I'm going to write my state. Sorry. I'm going to write my state as a sum of something times sigma plus something else times zero. So in order to get the what I might call sigma for this guy, the basis functional to pick this out, that has to be the zero annihilator. And the one that I might call zero has to be the one that annihilates sigma. So this is not the same as this. They're two different functionals. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay.
But the point is that once you have,
you
can forget about the basis, right?
If I ever need the basis, of course, when I have the whole basis, there is a correspondence between the entire basis and the entire dual basis. Okay? So I have to have the whole basis in order to make that work. The point is, once I have these dual objects, Then they work without ever having to know what other dual objects are around.
Yeah.
They just tell me whether that effect will be possible or not. Okay, so all right. and by the way, notice that if I have a vector and a non-zero constant times a vector, a kind of a trivial thing in Z2. Modal quantum theory. But maybe you have a Z3 where you have plus one and minus one. And if you multiply this by a non-zero scalar, you get exactly the same possible results for any effect. And so that means that these guys are really equivalent. And of course, that's just like ordinary quantum theory, where if you multiply a vector by a state vector by a phase, it has all the same properties. So actually. Physical states are going to be equivalence classes of vectors. Okay,
So this looks very similar to actual quantum theory. A result is possible if this is not equal to zero, but this represents an inner product. Represents an inner product. And what that means is that there's a fixed association between a particular bra and a particular cat. Yeah?
I'm trying to understand this properly. With the effect functional, are you saying there's six things you could possibly measure sort of in this step two?
You're thinking of six or three. One of them is just two. Those are just different by relabeling. Yeah, exactly. That if I take any two of these functionals, they span the dual space. And a measurement contains enough functionals to span the dual space. For sorting out the different things. Otherwise, if they didn't span the dual space, by the way, then it might be that some state led to no possible results for the measurement. And that won't work. So. Okay. All right. So what do you do
once you have this this extremely interesting but sort of ridiculously simple theory? Well, what you do is you think about all the cool things you know about quantum mechanics, and you ask, is this also the case in modal quantum theory? What features of actual quantum theory are reflected in this much more primitive context? And so here's an example. The example is the Koken-Specker theorem. Some of you may know this. The idea is that if you have a spin one system, then the squares of the squares of the angular momentum components along three orthogonal axes are compatible measurements. You can make them all without any difficulty because it's the square of the angular momentum components and it's spin one. Because of that, it works out. And some of the PSI students will be remembering a homework problem. And when you do that. You always get results like this. You always get two of these guys having one as a result, and the other one having zero. And it might be 110 or 101 or 011, but it's always going to be something like this. Okay. Now, the Koken-Specker theorem goes like this. It says, look, suppose you wanted to imagine that the behavior of a spin one system what could be accounted for by some hidden variables. Now, quantum mechanically, you can only predict probabilistic outcomes, but maybe that's just due to our ignorance of some hidden factors, and so maybe the results of all measurements are predetermined. Okay, so that's the first idea. And the second idea is the idea of non-contextuality, which says that the value of, let's say, this component squared, the value of that component squared is not only predetermined, it doesn't matter whether you measure this component squared as part of this triad or part of another triad where these two vectors are rotated about that axis a little bit. It doesn't matter what the other two guys are, the value of this is just some value. And the question is, are these assumptions consistent with quantum theory? And what you can do is you can pick a whole bunch of directions in space. This is a construction that Asher Paris came up with, I think. It's much simpler than the original one. There are only 33 axes passing through the cube at these points, passing through the center of the cube. The original one had 117, so more complicated picture. The idea is what you do is if the result was going to be 1 along that axis, you'd color your dot red. And if the result was going to be 0, you'd color your dot green. And then you'd ask the question, can I color all these dots red and green such that if I take any three orthogonal directions, there will be two reds and a green? Two reds and one green. And the answer is no, you can't. You can't do it. You can't color those directions in that way. And so the Koken-Specker theorem, which is a little complicated, says that no theory of non-contextual hidden variables is consistent with the properties of the quantum spin one system. Yes?
There is a hidden variable theory in Bohm's theory. How does Bohm
It's the contextuality that what you would get for this measurement squared depends on what the other measurements that are made are, but it's not independent of that. Because when you have to analyze this, you have to analyze the measurement apparatus, and something that measured this triad would be a different measurement apparatus.
I understand that. Yeah. So in Bohm's formulation, the quantum potential assures that this is satisfied.
I don't know the way that Bohm handles this in detail, but I know that that this is where it has to fail. Okay, that this is where it would have to fail. I don't know the detailed story about that. So. But this is where that
would
have to, yeah.
What if our model
local? This is not about locality. We'll talk about locality in a bit. This is a non-local.
Bell's theorem.
Oh yes, that's a later slide. We'll talk about locality. This is contextuality, which is everything's happening right here where the spin is. But we're just assuming that the value of this component doesn't matter which other two orthogonal components I measure, whether I measure these, this component will be the same result. That's the assumption. And then locality is something related to non-contextuality, but has to do with a system that's composed of two parts that are perhaps separated in space.
I think the question is, does it matter if the hidden variable theory is local or not for this to be true?
The reason that I'm hesitating about how to answer that is that there are theorems that are related to Bell's theorem which make use of this structure for spin one particles, the Conway-Kochan free will theorem, which is a fairly recent example is one. But so this can be worked into a non-local experiment, but here there's only one system located in one place. There's no concept of locality that applies here. It's not divided into subsystems. It's not divided into subsystems. It's a single spin one system.
Okay,
so this looks kind of interesting and challenging. How does it work out in modal quantum theory? Well, let's go back to our Z2 MoBit, and let's look at our three bases for V star.
These bases right here, I've actually worked out I've written down what those three bases are, and written down also the things that agree with them. So for example, plus Z is the same thing as minus X, and plus y is the same thing as minus z, the basis functionals. Any two of the basis functionals give me a basis. So basically, I could imagine these functionals as sitting on the corners of a triangle, and any side of that triangle corresponds to one of the possible measurements. And so now I say I have two ideas that I want to check out. Hidden variables. The idea is that the results of all measurements are predetermined. That is to say, in a given instance of the experiment, for any measurement that I make, only one of the results is possible. The result is necessary. And the second idea is non-contextuality. It says whether an effect actually occurs or not doesn't depend on what other effects are part of the measurement. So if I have this effect, the plus x effect, the question is of whether or not that measurement result is true or not doesn't depend on whether that's actually the plus x in the x measurement or the minus y in the y measurement. These are the same functional. Okay, and so I'm going to make the non-contextuality assumption that it doesn't matter what the other functional is. I can answer the question unambiguously, or at least if I knew the hidden variables, I could answer the question unambiguously about whether this happens or not. So what that means is I want to color this triangle. In each individual instance of the experiment, I want to color the triangle, and I'm going to color it green if that functional corresponds to a result that's that happens. And I'm going to color it red if that functional corresponds to an instance that doesn't happen. And I want to know the following fact. Can I color this so that every side, every measurement, has exactly one green circle? And the answer is, no, I can't do that. No matter how you try to do it, you're always going to have some side that either has two red ones or some side that has two green ones, no matter how you try to color them in. And that means that no theory of non-contextual hidden variables is consistent with the MoBit properties. Yeah.
Possible, not possible.
In a particular instance of the experiment may come out with the thing that produces these systems may sometimes produce them one way and sometimes another. So the sets of possible results may reflect my modal quantum theory predicts more than one possible result simply reflects the fact that I don't know the details of how it was produced. And I'm assuming, though, that the results of the measurements are predetermined somehow, so that any particular instance of the experiment and any particular measurement that I make, one of the outcomes is possible and any other outcome is impossible.
Possible or necessary?
Well, if only one is possible, then it is necessary.
Okay.
Yeah.
For each of the three measurements,
and the non-contextuality says that I can simply reduce that to a graph coloring a problem for a triangle. Now, this is a lot easier than the other Koch and Specker argument. And it's easier because there's basically no concept of orthogonality that you have to work around, and because there are only a finite number of states anyway. Yeah?
I just want to get back to the original spin one business. Mm-hmm. From Neyman claimed to prove that you can't have hidden variables in mechanics.
Yes.
And Bell claimed to prove that Neyman was wrong. Now, are you saying that you've proved that hidden variables are not possible?
No. I'm saying that any successful hidden variable theory let me phrase it as a double negative, can't be non-contextual. That is to say, it has to be. It has to depend on a lot more details about the experiment. It can't be this very simple type of experiment. I'm not proving that there are no hidden variables. I'm saying that hidden variables would have to have a particular property that we may favor or not.
Bell's proof of the line was wrong to depend on the non-dispersive nature of the
Von Neumann's proof, as I recall it, involves some assumptions about how the algebraic properties of the operators are connected to measurement outcomes, and that assumption is not terribly plausible. I don't think. I think his theorem is a weak theorem because the assumptions that he has to make to prove it are very strong assumptions. And I think that what Bell was doing is sort of trying to find an example that sort of illustrated why this proof was so weak.
You see, to do the assumptions about the hidden variable, this is why von Neumann's proof failed.
Right. I think it's true as a theorem, but it's not as interesting and significant as he would have liked to have to make it so, because his hypotheses were too strong. Okay, so all right, so we have an utterly trivial Koch and Specker type theorem. Well, let's talk about entanglement,
so we can talk about locality and hidden variables. Composite systems have both product and entangled states. If we look at the, we can actually enumerate them in the finite cases very easily. If we have two MoBits in Z2 modal quantum theory, that's a that's a that vector space contains 16 vectors. One of them is a zero vector, so there are 15 possible states. 9 of them are product states. 3 possibilities for this guy, 3 possibilities for that guy. 9 product states, and the other 6 are entangled. Here's an example of one. The 0, 1 plus 1, 0 is an entangled state. Entanglement is interesting. What kinds of properties of entanglement do we have in modal quantum theory? For example, of course, in actual quantum theory, Bell's theorem says that the statistical correlations between entangled quantum states are inconsistent with the idea that the probabilities are due to hidden variables that function locally. So you get a quantum mechanical violation of some Bell inequality, which is an inequality that must be true, statistical inequality, linear inequality in probabilities, essentially, that must be true for local hidden variable theories, but isn't true for some quantum mechanical situation. So can we exclude, in the same way, local hidden variable theories in modal quantum theory? We can't follow the Bell approach. The reason is the Bell approach is based on inequalities about probabilities or expectation values of numerical observables. And we don't have any probabilities. We don't have any expectation values. So we can't do that. We have to do something else. But luckily, there's something else we can do. So I want to remind you, or at least all but one of you, about Hardy's theorem. Lucien can correct me if I get it wrong, but gently, please. So the idea is that you have a pair of qubits, qubit number 1 and qubit number 2, and the state you're considering is not a maximally entangled state like the singlet state of a pair of spins. It's a non-maximally entangled state, something between a product state and a maximally entangled state, somewhere in between. And then you imagine you have binary measurements which I'll designate A and B on each qubit. That is to say, measurements that whose results I'll label by zeros and ones. And that might be a measurement of a spin component or something. XY given XY, this simply refers to the joint result. This refers to the circumstance that I get this joint result from a joint measurement of these observables on the pair. That's what this notation means. And so what Lucien showed was that we can find A and B on qubit 1 and qubit 2 so that this result, where we get both zeros, where I measure A on the first one and B on the second one, or B on the first one and A on the second one, these results are both impossible. These results have probability zero. They can't happen. But getting both zero when you measure B's, that's possible. That occurs with some probability, and from time to time will show up in your experiment. But getting two ones, if you measure A's on both, is impossible. Probability zero. And you have to pick your measurements very carefully to do this. This is a delicate business, but you can do that. It's not too hard. The spin axes have to satisfy some fairly complicated trigonometric condition, but you can do that. Yeah? Any question?
Ones on B's is also impossible, or?
Oh, I don't know.
They don't know.
It might be. These are the only things that I want to note.
A and B are.
What?
There's no real definition on what A and B are.
Well, what I'm saying is, I'm not explaining the precise geometrical arrangement. I'm simply saying you can find A and B on system 1 and 2 so that these things are possible. Okay? All right. And now let me show you why this is bad. Okay, so under the local hidden variable assumptions, if this is possible, consider the instances where this is the values that would occur if we measured B on both cases. There must be such instances because this is a possible result. But since these guys are not possible, if I switched one of these guys from B to A, it would not be possible for these guys to remain zero because that can never happen. And I know that if I don't switch this second observable, I won't switch the outcome. That's the assumption of local hidden variables. If I switch only the first the observable in qubit number one, the qubit number two result will not change, then I know that these guys can't happen. And so that means that when, in those cases where this happens, and there are such cases, then I must have 1, 0, AB, and 0, 1, BA. If I measured AB, I get the joint result 1, 0. And if I measured BA, I get the result 0, 1. The 0 still has to be 0 because I'm considering only the cases where, when I measured both Bs, they both came out 0.
So you're considering counterfactuals, right? I mean, you're saying, like, if you were to do that, then we're going to consider the ensemble of states that satisfy that top one. And then if instead of doing BB, we had done something else, then we would have had to have done that.
Right. And the assumption of local hidden variables is essentially warrants us to talk in counterfactual ways.
Yes.
In exactly that way. Exactly.
Isn't there a tacit appeal to probabilities here? Because you're sort of saying if it's possible, then you'd expect it to happen eventually. But there's some kind of probabilistic notion.
There is an interesting
possible and never happen.
There is an interesting thing here. If I say that something has a certain probability, what is the empirical force of that statement? And different people would say something different. I think a lot of us would say, well, if I took a sufficiently large sample of similar experiments, then I would be able to get statistical frequencies that would have really good confidence estimating the probabilities. But you don't quite have that machinery if you only have the concept of modality. And that means that if I say that a particular result is a possible result, then I have to be a little bit careful about saying what the experimental implications of that are, right? Because it might be that I did the experiment a million times, that result never came up, and is it possible or not? It doesn't really say. However, in Hardy's work, the fact that this is possible, this is well separated from zero. So I could do an experiment many times, so that I would have as great a probability as great confidence in getting that result sometimes as I like. The point is that the statement that it's possible says that the theory works even in the presence of a particular instance in which this occurs. Is another way of putting it.
Yeah, but if you're going to discard probabilities and not think in terms of probabilities, it's not clear to me what you can say.
In an earlier version of this talk, all the slides where I was talking about quantum mechanics, actual quantum mechanics, had a different color to remind us that when we're going back to quantum mechanics to learn something about quantum mechanics, we can talk about probabilities to some degree. The point about this, let me make my point. The point about this slide is to guide us in our arguments about modal quantum theory.
I see. Sorry, okay? I thought you were saying you'd already got them.
No. Yeah, Bill.
Can I say that something is possible but will never occur in an experiment?
I don't know. And actually, this connection between a merely modal theory and how I think about experimentally confirming or disconfirming things, that's a really tricky question, and I don't know all the answers to that. Okay, that's really interesting. But I don't think I'll need that. What I think I'll need is simply that if something's impossible, you'll never see it. Okay, so the idea is that if in instances where this occurred, these things must also have occurred. And if these things occurred, if I now change the B's, both of these things must be true. So that means if I change B to A, I have to change it so that they're both one. Because if A is measured on the first one, I get one. If A is measured on the second one, I get one. So if A is measured on both of them, I get both ones. So this would have to occur in all the situations in which that occurs, but that contradicts the quantum mechanical prediction that this is impossible, a probability zero result. Yeah?
So, just a quick observation, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but in this box here,
yep,
non-contextuality is enforced by locality. Is that
correct? Right.
And that, think that was about non-contextuality, what you just said.
Locality is a kind of especially plausible non-contextuality. It's especially plausible because the things you fiddle with are not other things in that same system, but something on some other system that might be quite distant. So you can think of the locality condition as a kind of non-contextuality condition, a special, really powerful and plausible one. Okay, so this contradicts the quantum mechanical prediction that this is impossible, and so Hardy's theorem is that no local hidden variable theory is consistent with this set of possibilities and impossibilities. If this is possible, then I can reason about the instances in which that in which it is possible. All the instances in which that is possible are ones in which this must happen. I mean, all the instances in which this happens are ones in which this must happen. So if this is possible, this must also be possible. But it's not. So this set of possibilities this set of possibilities is inconsistent with any local hidden variable theory. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So let's since we have a version of a kind of a cousin of Bell's theorem that is based only on possibilities and impossibilities, that leads us to suspect that there might be something that we can do in modal quantum theory. Let me show you that. This state that I mentioned before kind of acts like the singlet state in quantum theory. It turns out it has the property that if you make parallel measurements, if you make the XX measurement or the YY measurement or the ZZ measurement, the same measurement on the two mobits, you always get opposite results. The superpositions don't contain any plus plus or minus minus terms. So the results of parallel measurements always disagree. Now, if you measure things that are not parallel, like ZX, when you expand this same state in those bases, you find that you have three terms but not the fourth one. So for each of these guys, there's one result, in this case the plus minus result for ZX, there's one result which is impossible, which can never occur. Okay, so what would it mean to have a local hidden variable theory for the singlet state? Well, it means that in each run of the experiment, the joint outcomes, the hidden variables, the joint outcomes exist for all the six possible measurements, the three on qubit on mobit 1 and the three on mobit 2. These joint outcomes all exist. And locality means I can say without ambiguity that the result for measuring X on the first one would be X, because that result doesn't depend on this. So for each particular run of the experiment, there's only one of this one six tuple that is possible. But the mobit state corresponds to perhaps a set of possible six tuples, which accounts for the fact that there are many possible results for some measurements. The state S corresponds to some collection of possible six tuples of the hidden variables. Now, let's see. What six tuples could appear in the set of possible six tuples? Which ones could appear? Well, the parallel measurements must always disagree. And so there are only eight six tuples that could conceivably appear, the ones in which all of the qubit 1 measurements disagree with the qubit 2 measurements. Otherwise, it would be possible to get the parallel measurements that agreed sometimes. So these are the only ones that can appear. And so that's so much for the parallel measurements. What can you say from the non-parallel measurements? Well, for example, if I measure ZX, then plus minus is impossible. So for example, plus Y plus and minus Y minus, where Y and Y prime are something else, this can't occur. And that lets me strike through two of the elements on the list.
and I have six such conditions. And in those conditions, I'll strike out more and more lists. It turns out that the top one and the bottom one, I strike out many times. But the net result is, I strike them all out. And so, that means that no local hidden variable theory is consistent with this set of possibilities and impossibilities for the two mobit singlet state. An entangled state of the simplest version, the simplest entangled state of the simplest version of modal quantum theory, has properties that cannot be explained by a local hidden variable theory. The correlations between the measurements. The rule simply being that if a result is impossible, it can't appear in my list. Everything that appears in the list would be problematic for some combination of measurements. Everything that I might write down. Okay. You can do all kinds of the entanglement games that you can do with regular quantum mechanics using modal quantum theory. Here's super dense coding. You guys may remember that. In super dense coding and for a regular qubit, a pair of qubits, you note that there's a basis of entangled states. The Bell basis is often used. And each of these guys can be turned into each of the other ones by operations that act only on one of the two qubits. We have exactly the same structure. You have exactly the same structure in modal quantum theory, which I've drawn here. So what happens is I start out with this joint state R. I separate it. And then Alice, let's say, makes a choice of some single mobit transformation that she performs on this one. There are four possibilities, so think of that as two bits of information. And then she returns that mobit, and Bob makes a measurement in this basis of entangled states. And from that measurement can determine with certainty which of Alice's four transformations were made. And so two bits go through here, even though there's only a single mobit that goes this way. The rest sort of, you know, this is kind of a backwards in time section, so only one mobit goes that way. Now that's really surprising in quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanical version of this is surprising. I think it's more surprising here. Here's why. There are only three possible mobit states for that mobit. Nevertheless, four distinct messages are transmitted from here to here. Okay? There are only three possible mobit states. I'm not counting dimensions of the space. I'm counting the number of elements of the vector space. Only three possible states, but that's somehow enough to together with this this entanglement, somehow enough to transmit four distinct messages. And you may ask the question, can you do teleportation? Yeah, you can do teleportation too. It's not as easy to explain because it involves relating the basis to the dual basis. Okay, what else? What's going on? Well, you can do all kinds of things that you might find surprising. For example, it's possible to talk about mixed states. Now, in quantum theory, the mixed states are represented by operators. Actual quantum theory, they're represented by operators, which are probabilistic averages of projections. Well, and those projections are outer products of a state with itself. Oh my goodness, we have nothing like that. So a mixture in this case is simply a collection of possible states. You have a collection of possible states. These are all possible. And then you say, what are the measurable results for that? What are the kinds of results you might get in various measurements? And what you find is that two different mixtures are equivalent, lead to the same predictions about what are possible and impossible if they span exactly the same subspace. So in fact, the mixed states, which we can represent by the span of an M, a mixed state is a subspace. The subspaces of the state space are the generalized notion of state. And that's all you have. They're not operators, but they are very natural mathematical structures. And it turns out that if you have an entangled state, it makes perfect sense to talk about the mixed state of one of the subsystems, and that gives you a basis-independent statement. It predicts the the right possibility results, and so you can do all the same things. And also, by choosing this basis, we can sort of steer the mixture to make that basis state. So you can do something like steering the ensemble or steering the mixture that you can do in a quantum entanglement situation. So a lot of the same things about mixed states hold for modal quantum theory, even though we have no density operators, no projection operators, no partial inner products, no anything, no partial traits. Okay, so that leads us to the last of the things I'm going to talk about today, the no cloning theorem. And you know, the proof of the no cloning theorem is in fact the original proof. It's the proof of Wooters and Zurich from 1982, which is based only on the linearity of the evolution of the state. And so you assume that this cloner is supposed to take an unknown state and a standard state for some blank paper, for this is a Xerox machine, and then it does some sort of operation, and each of these guys is supposed to wind up in the original state. And we assume that the machine works on distinct input states A and B. By distinct, I mean they're not multiples of each other. They're linearly independent of each other. Let's suppose it works on these guys, this and this. Now, the overall time evolution is linear because I've taken into account the fact that the machine itself may have changed its state. The overall time evolution is linear, so I consider the input, which is the sum of these guys. And then that evolves to the sum of these guys. That's not equal to this state. More to the point, you can see that the final state of the original modal system, or the clone, they both have the same final state, the final state is the mixture spanned by the AB states. It's a two-dimensional subspace, which is certainly not the mixture spanned by the C state, which is a one-dimensional subspace. So you can see that in modal quantum theory, you can't have a cloning machine that works on all input states.
I must have missed in your original description where you say that time evolution is linear.
Oh, right, that's in the absence of measurement, that T's, just linear, invertible linear transformation.
Is that an assumption?
That's a hypothesis of the theory, yeah.
So you put in linearity by hand?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay, so this is kind of an interesting game. There's an awful lot of things that modal quantum theory simply doesn't have. It's a very primitive theory. It doesn't have probabilities. It doesn't have expectations. It sounds like bad news for the theory if it doesn't have probability or expectation. It sounds like it's got very bad prospects. But anyway, it doesn't have probabilities or expectations. It doesn't have, for finite fields of scalars, it doesn't have continuous sets of states and observables or continuous time evolution. It's totally discrete theory. It doesn't have an inner product. It doesn't have an outer product. It doesn't have the notion of orthogonality. It doesn't have convexity, which is a really important thing when we start talking about mixed states and so on. It doesn't have an operation of Hermitian conjugation on its operators. There's no such operation. It doesn't have effect operators, the positive operators that correspond to outcomes of a generalized measurement. It doesn't have density operators. It doesn't have any of these things. There's a lot more that it doesn't have, but this is kind of a quick list. But what does it have? Even with such a primitive theory, we have many of the features of real quantum theory. Okay? Even such a primitive discrete theory has a lot of the theories. It has classical versus quantum theories. Like you can have a classical notion of how possibilities combine. You can have a quantum notion, which includes the possibility of interference. You can have superposition and interference. You can have complementarity, different observables on a system.
You can have you have linear dynamics that's built in. You have a measurement theory that involves these effect functionals, these things that live in the dual space. You can have entanglement, superdense coding. You can have mixed states. You can have steering of ensembles in the case of a mixed state produced by an entangled pure state. There are no local hidden variables possible. There's no cloning. A lot of other things. There are non-classical models of computation based on machines that function according to modal quantum theory. And both of these lists are heavily truncated. Okay? So what's the point of this? The point is to put across how very much simple linearity gives you in quantum theory. This theory is designed to be the most primitive linear quantum-like theory you can imagine. Yeah?
Regarding complementarity.
Yes.
Since your operator T is not limited, how can you prove Heisenberg matrix mechanics is equal to wave mechanics?
I can't. That's not the complementarity I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the fact that you have incompatible measurements on a system. That you'll get into trouble if you imagine that all measurements have definite results ahead of time. That each individual system can be addressed, if you will, and interrogated in distinct incompatible ways. The complementarity in that case between something like position and momentum. Now there is actually a Heisenberg representation for this, rather than having the dynamics act to the right on the state, it acts to the left on the basis functions.
Thank you.
But that's a fairly trivial thing here because we don't have a huge dynamical theory underlying.
So you don't have a dynamical theory equivalent to quantum mechanics.
No, it's not equivalent to quantum mechanics. It's as I said at the outset, this is not necessarily to be taken as real physics. But it's taken to be an exercise in understanding what the logical connections are within quantum theory. And here, by weakening quantum theory in many, many ways, we nevertheless retain a huge amount of the machinery of quantum theory. Yeah?
So going back to this question of evolution, it seemed like everything you did up until that slide on no cloning didn't have anything to do with evolution.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Okay, so then linear dynamics was put in by hand. So if you were to strike that, then most of these things on this list would stick around, except for maybe no cloning
It's not quite that. The superdense coding also relied on the linear transformations of the single qubit states, for example.
Okay.
And teleportation, which I mentioned but didn't actually go into, does rely on that. And so if you have nonlinear dynamics, then by combining some dynamics with a measurement, then you might be able to get measurement processes that are not describable in the framework that I've given. And so I don't know what all the implications of that are.
If you have nonlinear dynamics.
Let me just quickly say that there's going to be another talk about this in a couple of weeks by Michael Morland, so you can find out more.
Are you finished?
I'm finished.
Let's sort of move on to the question session.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. The question is, the question here is how much, what burden is sort of being carried by the linear dynamics? What happens if you adjust that assumption? And the on the one hand, we can extend that assumption to talk about things like generalized quantum evolutions. And that'll be part of this talk. And that's a really interesting story, but it's a little more technical. The second thing about that is that if I have this basic measurement system, the basic system of thinking about measurement, and I have the possibility of some highly nonlinear dynamics. And by first doing some highly nonlinear dynamics on the system and then doing one of these measurements, I might be able to construct a measure of procedure that's not simply describable as a set of functionals. Okay? With this structure, you don't get anything new by having dynamics happen first before you make your measure. And so the structure is designed to be reasonably closed. If I allow it to open up in various ways, then I don't know how it'll break. But this is pretty clearly consistent.
Just as the tradition is, maybe we can take questions from site students first.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
If you had a canonical way of going from normal quantum setup to this model setup, then you would be able to predict assertments, like these things predicted?
So far, we don't have any results that allow us to build a modal system out of real quantum mechanics, or build real quantum mechanics out of a modal system, which would be much more interesting. So far we don't know about that. We proceed entirely by analogy. You say, here's a quantum setup. What's a modal quantum setup that captures some of the essential details? So we don't really have a way of just sort of doing the same experiment in modal quantum theory. It's too different. It's too different to do that.
But if you have one, you will be able to test quantum mechanics against other theories.
Oh, well,
this before we.
I'm not sure. I've quite promoted this to the status of a theory that I know how to test. This is a science fiction story. Or even a fantasy story, more technically, about another universe in which there's no notion of probability. What can we say about in such a universe if it had quantum-like laws? Yeah.
There's a question here.
I just have a simple question about the Hardy's theorem. But
yes.
You prove it, you have to choose a special basis of the vector space and its dual space. So how do you argue that it's space independent of the whole proof?
Oh, I see. In the structure of one of these no local hidden variable theorems works like this. There, what you do is you say there is a quantum mechanical situation which cannot be explained by local hidden variable theories. And so even if you pick a very specific, very carefully adjusted example, that one example suffices, that one example is enough to show that the local hidden variable theories won't do the job for all the quantum mechanical situations. So it's like constructing a counterexample in mathematics. Your counterexample can be extremely special. And you're not making any, in the case of the Hardy theorem, you're not making any claims about a typical state with a typical set of measurements. It's a very specially constructed state with a very specially constructed set of measurements, but that is enough to show that the local hidden variable theories won't explain the behavior of that state with those measurements. I don't know if that's an answer to your question. Okay.
Any more questions from sessions?
I think it was on the third slide or something, you introduced the three bases, X, Y, and Z, and you said that you said that, say, you have the one basis 1 and 0, and then you have the basis sigma and 0. And
yeah.
If you have the state sigma, then you can't measure 0.
If your state is sigma, okay, and you expand it in this basis, it's a superposition of both basis vectors. If you expand it in this basis, it only involves the first basis vector. And therefore, the question of whether or not the zero vector is involved in the superposition depends crucially on what the other vectors in the basis are.
Okay, but that doesn't make sense to me in the physical sense, that somehow that if you choose a different basis, then the physics changes.
These bases don't have any concept of orthogonality. And so, for example, I say, here's a vector in space, and I'm going to consider a basis of vectors that are not actually orthogonal to each other. Here's a vector pointing this way, and I have one of my basis vectors points that way, and I say, is this basis vector part of the linear combination that leads to that? And the answer might be yes, might be no, because this vector itself might be a basis vector, because they can both be, in which case I wouldn't need any of this guy. So because there's no concept of orthogonality, then I can't simply answer the question without knowing the whole basis.
So I'll open it now more generally. I think Robert.
Yeah.
So yeah, what I find quite intriguing, it's not only the modality, but it's the simplest modality. You've got a Z2 field. So
sometimes you need to go to Z3 to see the really interesting behavior. But
well, that's what I'm wondering. Do you get anything more if you go to more complicated fields that are finite?
So in Z2, as I said, there's only one kind of interference. It's destructive. You add 1 + 1, you get 0. But in Z3, you can have both destructive and non-destructive interference because 1 + -1 is 0, but 1 + 1 is -1 in Z3. And so there you just have a somewhat richer set of states. And for example, when we've been hunting counterexamples to conjectures, we sometimes had to go to higher order fields to show that something to higher characteristic fields in order to show that something is to show that our conjectures are false, okay, in general. Sometimes the MoBit structure is just too special.
Okay, so then, like, a follow-up question the other way. You've stripped this down and got almost everything you get in quantum mechanics from this simple thing. Can you strip it a little further and retain some stuff, but lose other features?
I'm not quite sure what to take out. that's a really interesting question. For example, perhaps I want to start messing with the tensor product rule. I kept that intact. I do know how to generalize the notion of state to a mixed state, the notion of measurements to a more general notion of measurements. I know how to do that properly. I also know how to do generalized dynamics, but within this theory. But I might allow even more generalized dynamics and see what the consequences are. I don't know how to take more axioms out. I don't know how to get a theory that's smaller. Yeah. If I do, please.
There's lots of questions.
Yeah. There used to be an argument in quantum cosmology of Bob Grosch and Jim Hartle that you didn't need an inner product, and all you needed to know was where the wave function vanished, and you didn't have a notion of precluded and not precluded, which is a lot like your modality of impossible and possible. And they gave an incorrect argument in quantum mechanics that you could reproduce probabilities from the notion of a relative frequency operator.
Right, that was in some sort of infinite limit.
Right.
You found that any product state is an eigenstate of the frequency operator.
Yeah, so I wonder if some argument like that would let you reconstruct quantum mechanics in Europe.
We would love to do that. We don't know how to do that though. So for example, if you just take a probability distribution, like a coin flip, okay, and say it's a weighted coin, so one heads is more likely than tails, and you flip it a billion times, then if you look at the structure of that very complicated distribution, which is really a product distribution, if you look at the structure of that, then it's almost like there's a set of a bunch of atypical results that have total probability almost nothing, and there's a set of results that are typical with about the right frequencies, which are all about the same likelihood. So it's almost as if, asymptotically, by something called the asymptotic equipartition principle, if you look at it asymptotically, it's almost like it's kind of like it loses its distinctive probabilistic character and simply has a distinction of are you in the set or not,
right.
Okay? But I can't go any farther than that because I don't know how to do it.
But that's where that argument fails.
Yes, exactly. They went ahead and took the limit so that there was a sharp answer to whether you're in the set or not.
Right, which turned out to you required the inner product to take the limit and therefore it avoided the argument.
Right, right. But
Bill?
Could you do the GH set argument?
I don't have a GHZ type example, but that'd be a really obvious thing to look at, wouldn't it? Now that you mention it,
because it seems to be. I mean, that's very modal.
Okay, I'll work it out tonight. Well, maybe I'll give it a shot because that's a great suggestion. Yeah.
Yes.
So you had on one of your slides non-classical models of computation.
Yeah.
So yeah, you got us into our computation.
Okay. So
I'll let
you. If you all right. So. What can I say here? Let me just say something heuristic, and that'll have to do for today. And that is that if you look at something like the quantum computing algorithm for something like the Deutsch-Jozsa algorithm, then it really only involves positive and negative one amplitudes, and there's some normalization factors, but they aren't really very important. And so if you can almost exactly translate that algorithm to a computer built out of Z3 modal quantum theory, okay? So that suggests that that at least some of the interesting tricks that you can play with a quantum computer are adaptable to this more primitive idea. This is and you might be able to design to come up with some funny computational classes, for example, things that you could do if you had a Z3 modal quantum computer in polynomial time. That would be a different class than the set of things that you could do, especially oracle problems.
The thing that's most interesting to me is that this isn't obviously contained in B-cube. No. This isn't obviously.
I don't know how to simulate modal quantum theory with a quantum computer. I don't know how to simulate a quantum computer with a modal quantum theory. I don't know how to do the simulation. These may be inequivalent. And since this is a whole class of theories, it might be really interesting to sort of map out how that works. Sorry to take that a long time to answer the question.
Okay, there's still many questions, but I guess there is this on the next page.
What?
There's another discussion.
Which will extend these results in significant ways.
So if you want to hear more, you can come to this talk. But let's thank our international director.